This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Poet Laureate of the United States, Ted Kooser, and here he is with an opening poem.
Morning glories. We share so much. When I write lattice, I count on you seeing the flimsy slats tacked into squares and painted white, like a French door propped in a garden with the blue condensed from many skies pressed up against the panes. I count on you knowing that remarkable blue, shaped into the fluted, amplifying horns of Edison cylinder record players. What? Come on, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I didn't need to describe them like that, but I like to hover a little over my words, dabbling the end of my finger in the white throats of those. You fill it in. I could go on, but all I really needed to do was to give you the name and the title. I knew you'd put in the rest, maybe the smell of a straw hat hot from the sun. That's just a suggestion. You know exactly what else goes into a picture like this to make it seem as if you saw it first, how a person can lean on the warm hoe handle of a poem, dreaming, making a little more out of the world than was there just a moment before. I'm just the guy who gets it started.
That's the voice of Ted Kooser, and he is this year's winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Today we're reading from a book that isn't exclusively Ted's poems. So tell us what this book is.
This is a book called The Poetry Home Repair Manual. I wrote it. It's really more of a philosophy of writing than a writing manual. I have a good deal of information in it about technique and craft and so on, but it's more about suggesting that people think about the audience for poetry and steer their work toward an imaginary reader and so on.
And how long did this book come together? How long did it take in the making?
Assembling it probably took around a year. What I had done was I teach tutorially at the University of Nebraska. I have 12 students. I give them each an hour apiece a week privately.
Wow.
And then when I want to talk to all of them at once, I would send them an email, and I began doing a sort of a, like an email lecture about a poem. I'd find a poem, and then I'd type it into the email, and then I'd talk about it. And so I saved these emails, and they all sort of came together in this book. I mean, there's a lot of other writing in it as well, but that was the basis of it.
Well, we're going to taste a little from each chapter. There are 12 chapters, and we may not hit all of them, but we're going to give you the meat from several of them. And for just starters, let us read a poem. It's on page 3, I think. It's called The Poet.
Once you were young along a river, tree to tree, with sleek black wings and red shoulders. You sang for yourself, but all of them listened to you. Now you're an old blue heron with yellow eyes and a gray neck tough as a snake. You open your book on its spine, a split fish, and pick over the difficult ribs, turning your better eye down to the work of eating your words as you go.
That is by Ted Kooser. Not all the poems you'll hear today are by Ted, but they are poems he's chosen because they're significant for one reason or another. And what is this poem about? It's called Poetry Reading, right?
Yes. It's about the difference between being a poet and writing poems, and that when you're young, often you're much more involved and absorbed by being a poet and wearing the beret and the black turtleneck and being sexy and interesting. And then when you get older, you're more interested in the poems you've written and so on. So it's a transitional poem.
But in this chapter, it's very important because it lays the groundwork for the book, and it invites everyone to the party in a way. It says, you are entitled.
Yes,
you're allowed to try your hand.
That's right. I see nothing wrong with a world in which everybody is writing poems. They may not be publishable poems, but what better way of using your time, you know?
And you said it keeps one more scoundrel off the streets.
That's right. Yeah.
I think that's better. Instead of scoundrel, poet.
Yeah.
Good trade-off. Yeah. So that is how the poem begins, by saying, this is a world you can enter. Why not try your hand at it? And then we proceed with the nuts and bolts of it, which is about the Poetry Home Repair Manual. And we go into the specifics. For example, first impressions. I think that that's a title of a chapter, isn't it? First impressions?
Yes, it is. Yes, it
and
is,
what
yeah.
does first impressions mean?
Well, it means the opening line, the title and the opening lines of a poem, how they affect a reader. You know, it's very much like meeting a stranger in life. You don't walk right up to them and begin shouting into their face. You know, you move with some grace toward them, you know, and that's the way I think poems should open, not necessarily all of them, but can open effectively, I guess.
That's a good point, mm-hmm. because I always tell students it's like walking into a room. Do you want to knock over a chair, you know, or kick someone in the shin?
Yeah, that's very good, yeah.
Yeah, so you do have some samples there we'd love to hear, and one of them, I think, is called The Bell Rope.
The Bell Rope.
That's on page 28. That's a very nice entry.
Yes, this is a poem of Robert Morgan's, and it moves very smoothly from conversation towards something else. Bell Rope. The line through the hole in the dank vestibule ceiling ended in a powerful knot worn slick, swinging in the breeze from those passing. Half an hour before service, Uncle Alan pulled the call to worship, hauling down the rope like the starting cord of a motor. And the tower answered and answered, fading as the clapper lolled aside. I watched him before Sunday school heave on the line as on a well rope, and the wheel creaked up there as heavy buckets emptied out their startle and spread a cold splash to farthest coves and hollows, then sucked the rope back into the loft, leaving just the knot within reach, trembling with its high connections.
What was the point that you made about that poem?
Well, it's just that you are into the poem before you even notice that you're on the way.
Mm.
You know, it is that conversational and that smooth an entry into the poem. And I was trying to talk about that. This is the way that you ease a person into the sort of the pew of the poem in the church of the poem.
And it also moves from the concrete to the abstract in that poem very skillfully.
Yes, very skillfully. Bob Morgan is a tremendous poet. Yeah.
And one thing I really loved about this book is that I met poets I had never met before. You have introduced me to poets, I think, many of whom were not well published, perhaps even.
Mm-hmm.
But you've come along in your life and you've found a poem and you have really made a very important indentation in their lives.
Well, thank you. I have copied out poems that I've seen for years and years in file folders and so on, and it was just a matter of going through and finding them again. And it is true that some of these poets are very little known. They should be better known, but, and maybe this will help a little
bit. Well, as poet laureate, I think you can accept that compliment, that of all the poet laureates, you have really opened very large doors for people and for us. You know,
well, thank you,
we want to thank you for that. And along that line, we have another poem that you point out, which I thought was very interesting, by Joseph Stroud. And here you say there's very inventive ways of using a first line
mm-hmm.
of a poem. Sometimes it can be incorporated into the body of the poem. So let's hear that one.
Yes, this one is particularly interesting because the title of the poem is actually the last line of the poem moved forward, because it follows in sequence from the narrative, and you can pick it out from the example. The title is, "And I Raised My Hand in Return." Every morning for 2 weeks on my walk into the village, I would see the young goat on the grassy slope above the stream. It belonged to the gypsies who lived in the plaza below the castle. One day on my walk back to the mill house, I saw the little goat hanging from a tree by its hind legs, and a gypsy was pulling the skin off with a pair of pliers, which he waved to me in greeting. And then, of course, the title is, "And I Raised My Hand in Return," as if perhaps he raised it inadvertently, you know, to wave back, you know.
But look at that poem. I think it's about 8 lines.
Yes.
How much is accomplished? We have a view of another culture.
That's
right. A
whole
culture is introduced in that.
Right.
And the matter-of-fact way of skinning an animal, which isn't something you see walking down the street in Washington.
With a pair of pliers.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we believe this is an American poet.
Mm-hmm.
Raising his hand in return.
Oh, yeah.
So much is happening mm-hmm. psychologically.
Absolutely.
So that was a really nice... I don't know this poet.
Well, he lives in California. He's published, I believe, 2 or 3 volumes with Copper Canyon. I really admire his
work. I'm
going to
look him
deal.
Up.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. We're at the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri with Ted Kooser, who is author of Poetry Home Repair Manual. And we're going through it a little bit by little bit because it's the book. If you want to choose one book to teach your class, this is the one. It's from the University of Nebraska Press, and you can simply get it by going on the internet and getting their address. It is also, I think, on the shelf now. Is it on the shelf?
Oh, yeah.
In bookstores.
Yeah.
Okay. So we are talking about entry lines and good titles, and that is what the chapter First Impression is about. Then you go into the idea of there are really no rules,
mm-hmm.
chapter four.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, don't worry about the rules. Okay, what are the rules in poetry?
You know, I believe that a poem is a record of a discovery. The discovery can be made in life, it can be made in language, and so on. But the poem then records the discovery. And the only rule really worth establishing for yourself is, does it meet the standards that you want for the poem? And you have to decide that yourself. There are poems that are written that are very loose and free, and you can move words around in them without damaging the poem so much, and that is one person's standard of poetry. There are poets like me who can't do that, can't stand to have that kind of freedom, you know, that I don't want any word that can be moved around in my poem or any punctuation mark without diminishing the effect. That's my standard. But everybody can set their own standards, and I guess that's a rule about not having rules in a way.
Good point. Yeah. Are you still learning how to write poetry?
Oh, yes, yeah, with every poem, sure.
What was the last thing you learned?
Oh, gosh, Grace, I can't remember.
But are you writing this year at all?
I'm not. I haven't been able to do much writing this year. I've been so busy.
I know. Accepting all those awards, it fills the day. Going up to get the Pulitzer,
another. It's the mail. It's the correspondence and the phone calls and that sort of thing. And also, you know, being out talking to a lot of people and so on. And I don't mind putting off writing for a couple of years, you know. I mean, it's something that I certainly miss, but this is a very important job, and I want to do it well. I want to especially do it well since I'm the first poet laureate from the middle of the country and or from the Great Plains, and you know, I want to prove to everybody that we guys can do it out there, you know.
And that brings up another theme of your book, and that is that to be a poet is to be of service. That
I
is
think
part
so.
Of that's the mandate.
I think that's absolutely true, yes.
It's not a bad thing to live for something bigger than yourself.
That's right.
You know, most of the poets I know are pretty high consciousness, and they don't make a lot of money, as you know, but there's something more important about being alive, and this book is about entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
In this book, you're saying every chapter, hey, this is the way this person does it, this is the way you might want to do it.
Yeah.
It's not... exactly, that Mount Olympus is too small.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yeah. Ted Kooser, Grace Cavalieri together again, and I'm glad. We're talking about Poetry Home Repair Manual, and we then move into, we say there are no rules, but there are things called form and syllabics
mm-hmm.
and syllables, and you tackle that. So there are a few poems in there that are significant in what they reveal. Kim's poem, The Aquarium. Let's read that one.
Yes, this is Kim Adonisio, Aquarium. The fish are drifting calmly in their tank between the green reeds, lit by a white glow that passes for the sun. Blindly, the blank glass that holds them in displays their slow progress from end to end. Familiar rocks set into the gravel, murmuring rows of filters, a universe the flying fox and glass cats, Congo tetras, bristle-nosed plecostemus all take for granted. Yet the Pleiades, gold and red, persist in leaping occasionally, as if they can't quite let alone a possibility of wings, maybe, once they reach the air. They die on the rug. We find them there, eyes open in surprise. Now that's a sonnet, but it doesn't sound like a sonnet, does it? It is so graceful and conversational that it doesn't, you don't feel the form.
Read the first line, and we'll hear the pentameter.
The fish are drifting calmly in their tank. Yeah, it's there.
So you can hear that, and you mentioned that in that chapter.
Yeah.
if you count that, the fish are drifting, what's the next word?
Calmly
in their tank. And each line is well grounded in pentameter, but it's, you wouldn't trip over it.
Yeah, and she varies the pentameter, you know, between the green reeds, you know, that sort of thing, so that it feels conversational. You know, it is driven by the pentameter rhythm carried along, but it is opened. It has been opened.
Then I bet that you wrote that poem in your book, but I bet you never read it out loud. And I have to give you credit for the name of that fish.
What was it? You got me.
When you got there, when you got to that fish, I thought, if I was reading that cold, I wouldn't have.
Yeah, well, I probably screwed up the names of all the fish. Plecostemus.
I think you did it.
Yeah.
I thought, I gave him a degree of difficulty.
I think she'll forgive me for that.
Right. Yeah. And I think she'd be grateful that somebody is on to her. Quite smooth.
She's a marvelous poet.
She's young.
Yeah.
She too
is a California poet. Yeah.
Yeah. And there is another in that chapter, which is not always pentameter. The men who raised the dead. That's a good example you use for syllables, if you will read that to us and talk about that poem.
The men who raised the dead. If they had hair, it was gray. The backs of their hands, wormy currents of blue veins, old men, the undertaker believed, had already lost too much to the earth to be bothered by what they found, didn't find. Brought there that May afternoon, dogwood trees bloomed like white wreaths across Jocassee's valley. They took their time, sought the shade when they tired, let cigarettes and silence fill the minutes until the undertaker nodded at his watch. And they worked again, the only sound the rasp and shuck of shovels as they settled deeper in graves twice dug, sounding for the thud of struck wood not always found, sometimes something other, silk scarf or tie, buckle, button, nestled in some darker earth, enough to give a name to. One quit before they were done, lay down as if death were now too close to resist, and so another stepped in his grave, finished up, but not before they shut his eyes, laid him with all the others to be saved, if not from death, from water. That's Ron Rash.
What a wonderful poem. Where is he from?
He's in. He teaches in North Carolina and has published several books now. The reason I use this poem in here is it's written in syllabics. That is, every line is counted, both the accented and unaccented syllables. Every line is exactly 7 syllables long.
Read us the line.
If they had hair, it was gray, or the backs of their hands wormy. Consistently 7 all the way through.
And what is the value of that?
I think, I don't know, from my point of view, if I were writing in that, and I have written that way, it is a matter of feeling a sense of order, I think, that it's a little, perhaps a little obsessive, but it's the feeling that you're really creating something that has an order to it, a structure to it.
It doesn't sound obsessive.
No, not at all.
You see, that's the beauty.
Yeah.
I think some people do, you know, but that one is really moves, that really flows.
Yeah, the book that this came from is, the whole book is written in this form. Every one of them, yeah.
The same syllable count per line?
7 syllables, yeah.
So you feel, you know, somebody's in charge of it.
Yeah, that's right.
And
it's
really a matter of trust, isn't it? Yeah, that's one thing we really, if there's one thing we have to punctuate, it's the reader who can relax and know that someone is in charge.
Yeah, that's a good point,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm. And I think that you aspire to that yourself, right?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You don't want a bunch of readers without boundaries.
No.
Running around wild, not knowing what you're talking about.
Yeah.
This is Ted Kooser, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're together at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're talking about a new book that tells you what Ted notices in poems, I guess. And some of the poems you've noticed you are putting in a newspaper column.
Yes, I have a new newspaper column that is free to any newspaper that wants to use it coast to coast or away from here. It's can be found at www.americanlifeinpoetry.org. All you have to do is go on there and download it from that. Newspapers are asked to register so we can keep track of what the circulation is. At the time that you and I are doing this show, we have been up and running for 5 weeks. We have, I believe the last report was around 55 papers signed up. We have a combined circulation of 5.6 million readers.
And describe the column.
Well, it's a short poem that I think newspaper readers can understand. I introduce it with two or three sentences. Let's say something like, poets sometimes do this, or have you ever noticed this, that sort of thing. Then a short poem, and then the credits, really.
That's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not off-putting. You see this, and it's all in place. It's all intact.
Yeah.
It's one page, and it's something you go right to. It's immediate.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of this book a lot. It has the same flavor.
Well, I suppose it would. I'm writing the columns. I have a couple of graduate assistants at the University of Nebraska who are helping me look for poems for it. But other than that, I'm doing the writing. So.
And that is a new idea. Who conceived of that?
Well, my wife is a newspaper editor in Lincoln, Nebraska. She's the editor of the daily paper there. And she and I have been talking about trying to get poetry back in papers for years and years. You know, it was in there for 200 years. And then the last century, it sort of drifted away, and we're trying to get it back. And I was very fortunate that the Poetry Foundation in Chicago gave me some money to pay for the graduate assistants and get it started. And they also built the website that we're using.
But it was Kathleen's idea.
It was Kathleen's
idea. We have to make that clear.
It was her idea, yeah.
We're going to read another from this book. And I think I'm going to ask you to read a prose poem. That is by Robert Bly. That's page 53. Just because I want the audience to know the whole panoply of the poems you choose.
Okay. Looking at a dead wren in my hand. Forgive the hours spent listening to radios and the words of gratitude I did not say to teachers. I love your tiny rice-like legs that are bars of music played in an empty church and the feminine tail where no worms of empire have ever slept, and the intense yellow chest that makes tears come. Your tail feathers open like a picket fence, and your bill is brown with the sorrow of an old Jew whose daughter has married an athlete. The black spot on your head is your own mourning cap.
And what is that poem referring to?
I really think that it is a description of a dead wren in his hand.
I do, too.
You know? And, of course, it's very typical of Robert Bly's work. It flies off in all sorts of directions from that, but every direction is tethered back to the original purpose of the poem.
And what do you think a prose poem is?
Well, I think it is poetry that is almost as carefully controlled as poetry in form. The difference for me, the principal difference, is that it is not as intimidating to new readers of poetry as a poem in form. You know, so many readers were discouraged from poetry in the schools and so on by having to find the one meaning of the poem as if it were a riddle. And the prose poem sort of, you know, you're into it before you realize that you're reading poetry. You think it's just another paragraph, you know. I mean, that's a very simplistic way of looking at it. But
one way. I asked Ray Whittemore, and he said it came from the French, and that's all we know.
Yeah, that's right.
I guess Valéry was the first
something.
Right. Yeah. But he said, I keep asking people for definitions, and that's a new one for me because I think you go from margin to margin, and it still needs the lyrical tension in the middle, though.
Oh, yeah, it does.
It's
different
from prose.
Yeah. And the prose poems that are strongly narrative don't feel quite right. The more lyrical they are, that's the way I respond to them.
Well, people are getting away with murder with prose poems.
Yeah.
You know, they're just setting the typewriter from end to end, metaphorically.
Well, the nice thing about people getting away with murder in any kind of poetry is that the poetry is not likely to endure. You know, they are much more ephemeral, I think.
And it can't hurt anybody.
It cannot.
This is a murder that cannot hurt a soul.
It can't hurt a soul. Yeah.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our guest is Ted Kooser, who is Poet Laureate of the United States. We're back now, and